an FCIC interview with Alex Kirk of Lehman Brothers. It is August 16th, 2010, 4 p.m. from the FCIC. You have Troy Burris, Chris Seifer, Joby Dan Gannon, and Sarah Knauss.
Give you the little blurb, and then we'll get to the substance. As you have probably heard on other interviews, counsel, and now Mr. Kirk, you can hear, we're with the FCIC. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tasks us with determining the various causes of the financial crisis. It also tasks us with looking at every institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. It also tells us to specifically look at the issue of systemically important institutions and the issue of too big to fail. Those are some of the reasons we are looking at Lehman Brothers and some of the reasons we've asked to talk to you, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. Before we get into the substance of your time at Lehman Brothers, can you summarize for us your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Sure. This is Alex. I went to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. I have a BA in economics. I graduated in 1982. I went to work after my graduation at a firm called Kidder Peabody. I worked at Kidder Peabody from 1982 until 1994. When I went to Lehman Brothers, then I worked at Lehman Brothers from 1994 until 2008.
Okay. Can you take me through your positions at Lehman? And if my understanding is correct, your tenure at Lehman, there was a gap in there at some point, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. What would you like me to start at the beginning of my career at Lehman Brothers?
Yes, please.
Or what? Okay. So I went to Lehman Brothers in 1994, the end of 1994, to run the distressed securities business for Lehman Brothers. I had that job from 1994 till 2001. In 2000 and early 2002, I was promoted to run the high yield and leveraged loan business for the firm. I had that job from approximately 2002 until 2006. In early 2006, I was promoted to run global credit for the firm, which includes high yield, high grade corporates, emerging markets, and structured credit. I had that job from early 2006 until the fall of 2007. In October of 2007, I was promoted to co-chief operating officer of Global Fixed Income. I had that job from October of 2007 until January of 2008 when I left the firm. And then I returned to the firm in July of 2008. And I was named to a position of global head of principal investing for the firm when I returned.
Okay, thank you. So, all of those positions, at least starting in 2001, I take it that was in the capital markets segment of the firm?
All of those positions were in the capital markets businesses of the firm, with the exception, including the ones prior to 2001.
Okay.
With the exception of, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure what part of the firm I would have called principal investing. It was a hybrid position, I guess.
Okay. So, and that was what you returned to in July of 2008, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. So in looking at the, I just want to make sure I understand the basic structure of the firm. In looking at the company's public filings, you know, within the capital markets, we see the fixed income division and the equities division, at least in terms of that's how they publicly report their financial results. Am I correct in assuming that why don't I just ask, in 2006, when you're in charge of global credit, where does that fit into the organizational structure of the firm? Is that either within equities or fixed income within the capital markets?
That's within fixed income division, as were all of my jobs up until global principal investing were inside of the fixed income division of the firm.
Okay, so in 2006, when you're head of global credit, who do you report to?
In 2006, I reported to the global head of fixed income, who was Mike Gelband.
Okay. And then what about in October of 07 when you become co-COO?
So in April of 2007, Roger Nagioff replaced Michael Gelband as global head of fixed income. And I reported to Roger both in the global head of credit job from April until October, and again, I reported to him in the co-COO job as well.
Okay. And, all right. So, I know, and then you leave, what are the circumstances of leaving the firm in January of 08?
January of 08, Roger Nagioff had resigned from the firm. This was contemporaneous. And the senior management of the firm, Dick Fold and Joe Gregory in particular, decided to appoint Andy Morton as head of fixed income. And they thought it would be a good idea if I moved on.
Okay. Had you expressed an interest in that job? In the job that Morton was appointed?
I had not expressed an interest in the job, and in fact was not interested in the job.
Okay. Did they ask you to take it?
No, they did not.
Okay. All right. Is this what was the other one? Is this around the same time that Mr. McDade left the firm, or did Mr. McDade leave the firm around this time? Do you know?
No. Okay. Mr. McDade didn't leave the firm until the firm went out of business in the fall of 08.
Okay. That's right. Okay, so explain to me the circumstances of your return in July, which I understand is at the same time that Mr. McDade also brings back Mr. Gelband.
That is correct. In late June of 08, Bart McDade was appointed president and succeeded Joe Gregory as president of the firm. When he assumed those duties, inside of a week, he had asked Mr. Gelband and myself to return to senior roles in the firm and to help, his words, steer the firm in a solid course and good direction.
And did you report to Mr. McDade when you returned?
Yes.
Okay. Did you report to any? Did you also report to Mr. Fold?
I wasn't exactly clear on the structure. I was never explained to me what the actual reporting lines were from that standpoint. From a day-to-day operational standpoint, I assumed that I reported to McDade.
Okay, and what were your, generally at least, what were your job responsibilities when you returned in July of 08?
When I returned in July of 08, I assumed the responsibilities of head of principal investing. That job had been filled by David Goldfarb prior to me. And it was my responsibilities to first make sure that there was a broad net around all the principal risks that the firm was taking, even within the divisions, fixed income and equities, et cetera. We would move to rolling all of that risk up into me, and it was my job to risk manage some of the individual proprietary traders and then broaden out to try to manage a more broad set of that risk.
Okay, so who's, when you come back in July of 08, who's heading up the capital markets segment?
So when Mike Gelband and I came back, Mike was appointed head of capital markets. So the head of fixed income, Candy Morton, reported to him, and the head of equities, Jerry Donini, reported to him.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I'm just not writing fast enough. I hear that Morton reports to him, and Morton is, I'm sorry, in charge of equities or fixed income?
No problem. He's in charge of fixed income.
Okay. And then who was the person that was in charge of equities?
Jerry Donini, D-O-N-I-N-I.
Okay. And and they're both reporting to Gelband. And then, I'm sorry, but just help me understand, how do you fit into this structure?
I am outside the direct capital markets. There were some proprietary positions and traders that were taken outside of the equity and fixed income divisions.
Okay.
So I assume those responsibilities. So I have a parallel job.
Okay. Now I know, from other interviews and looking at a lot of documents, including the Veloukis report and others, that of course in these next 2.5 months before the bankruptcy, after you return, that the company is working fast and furious to either raise capital, find an acquirer, and dispose of assets. Are you involved in any of those three types of functions?
I was not involved in any efforts. I was most involved in the effort to dispose of assets. I was tangentially involved in the efforts to deal with acquirers.
Okay. Can you explain your involvement in trying to dispose of assets?
Number one, the groups that I was, the proprietary traders that I was directly responsible for, I worked with them on a regular basis to dispose of, get their risk down and their funding requirements down. Number two, I was asked to help design and execute a strategy to continue the reduction in the real estate assets in the last couple of months. So I worked closely with Mark Walsh and his team around the sale of those assets. And number three, I was asked to help oversee the fixed income risk and make sure that we were trying and we were pushing the traders in fixed income, because of my history with them, to reduce that risk as well.
Okay. When in your efforts to dispose of assets, and particularly the real estate assets, were you finding that Lehman was able or not able to sell them for the values they were carrying them on the books for?
I believe the real estate guys would be able to answer this much better than I could. I was helping them in a broader strategy as opposed to specifics. But I do remember seeing some documents out of the real estate group that indicated they were selling them very close to where they were marked, the ones that they were selling.
Okay.
Obviously, they had a very large book, so they sold a fraction of their entire exposure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things we've seen in the documents, and in particular in the Veloukis report, are references to the fact that perhaps one of the reasons Lehman was not selling assets more is because they weren't able to sell them at the values they were carrying them on the books for, which would indicate to folks that the values were too high, that there were error in the marks, as I think some government officials like Geithner and Bernanke may have told the bankruptcy examiner, and that would, you know, not be that would therefore send a negative sign to the market and make Lehman have troubles with funding in terms of haircuts for repos and things like that. Any knowledge of anything like that while you were there in this July to September time frame?
No. The only constraint that I observed on the sale of those assets was the physical manpower to deliver the documents and the analysis and respond to the myriad of investor queries on what literally were thousands of line items. You know, so I saw nothing that in those 2.5 months that led me to believe that they were trying to do anything but expedite as quickly as possible as large and as many sales as they could.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved at all? Let's jump ahead to the Lehman weekend. And of course, we know that the government put together this private consortium of bankers to, amongst other things, value the assets and come up with a long-term capital management type SPE to acquire the assets that apparently Barclays and B of A were unwilling to purchase. Were you involved in that valuation effort at all?
I was at the Fed that entire weekend. I was less around the specific that valuation effort. Those were others, and I was more around the high-level strategy, M&A, and dealing with the government officials, et cetera. I spent my weekend with Mr. McDade.
Okay. Go ahead.
That's it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I interrupted you. I mean, we've seen in the documents and in the report that the consortium's values on the assets were ballpark in the high teens, low 20s, where Lehman's marks were in the mid to high 30s. Do you recall the private consortium coming in with marks that were substantially lower than Lehman's values?
I actually never saw any consortium marks. The only marks that I saw were marks put on the portfolio of assets by Bank of America a couple of days earlier. I did not see any of the marks by the consortium.
Okay. Understanding you didn't see any marks by the consortium, did you ever hear from anyone or have any discussions with folks that the marks were coming in, you know, ballpark 50% of Lehman's marks?
No, I didn't hear that chatter either.
Okay, what were B of A's marks like compared to Lehman's?
I don't remember. I'm going to tell you it was a markdown somewhere in the mid-20s, but I don't recall exactly. There is a document, I think, referenced in the in the Veloukis report that has those numbers.
Okay. How did mid-20s compare to Lehman's valuations?
So that was on a balance sheet of approximately $600 billion.
Are you saying they were valuing $600 billion worth of assets at $120 billion?
No, I'm saying they were valuing them. If the balance sheet was $600 billion, they were valuing it at $575 billion, approximately.
I'm not following. Explain how marks in the help me understand. I hear you saying the marks were in the mid-20s, but I'm only hearing about a, if it's 575 over 600, that's like a 5%
mark. Right, but just to be specific, and again, I don't recall, I haven't seen the document in a long time, but what I want, Bank of America did a valuation of all of Lehman Brothers, because their purpose was they were going to buy the entire firm. They, what I saw was a mark on the entire firm's assets, which were about $600 billion, and we had about $30 billion of equity in the firm. So their marks, maybe the number was bigger than, wiped out the net worth, and it was about $25 billion that I recall. Again, I don't remember the exact numbers, which would have wiped out all the net worth of Lehman Brothers. But it really, because the asset base, Lehman obviously was very highly levered, so we had on $30 billion of equity, about $600 billion in assets.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Were you involved at all when you returned from the July to September 2008 time frame in dealing with any of the company's funding counterparties, whether it was the tri-party repo clearing banks, whether it was commercial paper holders or bilateral repo counterparties?
No.
Understanding you weren't involved, I'm still going to ask you some questions to know if you had heard anything about
sure.
it. Did you know, or did you hear anything about whether or not Lehman was having trouble with funding in this time frame?
Yes, there were at the margin over time. We were losing, I don't think we had much commercial paper outstanding.
No, you didn't.
But we were losing trading counterparties and some prime brokerage balances through that period of time as the stock went down. From July till September. And then, really, in the last week prior to the bankruptcy, I was aware JP Morgan and Citi and the other clearing banks had come in and demanded more collateral. All the way up till the Friday before the firm filed.
Excluding the week before the bankruptcy, because I know that is the week when, amongst other things, JP Morgan and Citi are asking for even more collateral. Do you know, or did you ever hear any discussions that while? Well, at the margin over time, you were losing trading counterparties and prime brokerage customers. Was there ever any, issue about actually being able to fund the company's assets?
Well, I don't recall as to whether the firm had retired all its commercial paper by the time I arrived, but certainly I knew that that was the plan if it had not been executed. So the firm had lined up liquidity to be able to basically retire all its commercial paper and not roll it. So certainly I was aware of that. In terms of financing counterparties and such, away from the prime brokerage and the other counterparties, I was not involved in discussions or specific discussions around funding in the firm. I knew, however, that it was a race, so to speak, to be able to try to continue to sell assets across the firm and raise additional funding, and that was paramount to the mission that summer.
Right, and understanding that you guys were racing to sell assets, all I'm really getting at is, other than the week before the bankruptcy, whether there was ever any concern or you had any discussions like, uh-oh, liquidity crisis, we're not going to be able to fund ourselves.
No, I was under the impression that the firm had a fair bit of liquidity, short-term liquidity. Obviously, we were very sensitive to where our debt prices traded and our equity price looking forward, but no, I don't. I was never part of a discussion, as you described, where we were like, oops, we've got a liquidity crisis in our hand up until the very last week.
Okay. Thank you. Now, one of the things we've seen in some documents is that in July of 08, apparently Dreyfus and Federated may have pulled their repo lines. Did you ever hear that? And two, do you know if it's true?
No, I did not hear that, and I do not know if that is true.
Okay. More generally, did you ever have any discussions directly with any Lehman funding counterparties or hear from anyone, whether from within Lehman or otherwise, about certain funding counterparties pulling out of Lehman?
I never had any discussions with any funding counterparties of Lehman's during that period of time, and I don't recall any specific conversations about specific counterparties pulling funding during that period of time. Again, it was quite clear that we were under those stresses and we were trying to scramble around, as you said, furiously to sell assets to basically absorb those stresses in the liquidity. Mm-hmm. But never thought that it was a an imminent issue as opposed to a medium-term issue.
Okay. Did you ever hear, and in particular in the July 08 time frame, any concern about any of your tri-party repo clearing banks thinking about not clearing your trades?
No. As a matter of fact, I was never, I didn't really even know what a tri-party clearing bank was until September 10th.
Well, you're ahead of me. I learned within this last year.
I'm beyond the most basic understanding. I'm sorry, what?
I was just being somewhat glib and saying I've learned about it this year.
Yeah.
So, okay. Thank you. All right. Go ahead.
Quick question. You mentioned a minute ago that perhaps before you left that Lehman had made a decision to line up liquidity to retire all of its commercial paper lines so it wouldn't have to worry about rolling them over, if I heard you correctly?
It wasn't before I left. It was in place by the time I came back.
My question was, I'm sorry, and I haven't asked it yet, but what I was wondering is when was that decision made and what exactly precipitated it?
I don't know when that decision was made. I believe that the firm always operated with enough liquidity in their in their liquidity models, as far as I understood, to always be able to pay off the commercial paper as it came due. Obviously, in most periods of time, they never did or had to, but they were always prepared. I think that was really a post-98 like decision. So that's my understanding of one of the things that went into the firm's liquidity framework.
Okay, so that was not a decision that was made in 2008?
No, that was a standing policy in the firm.
Okay. Thank you.
In the July 08 time frame, again, or actually at any time when you came back, were you involved in any efforts by Lehman to terms of looking at the possibility of becoming a bank holding company?
I was aware that Lehman was trying to do that. That effort was spearheaded by Tom Russo, but I was not directly involved.
Okay, did you have any involvement indirectly?
No.
Okay, I mean, we know that Lehman never applied to become a bank holding company. Do you know why they did not?
My understanding, again, this is from Tom Russo and others, was that Lehman asked to become a bank holding company and was denied.
By
whoever denies those bank holding. I don't recall who the counterparty was. I assume it was the FDIC or the Fed.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Oh, right. And obviously, Mr. Russo could probably fill us in on that, I take
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Did you, as when you come back in the July 08 and through the bankruptcy, did you ever have any discussions either with folks at Lehman or with the government about the possibility of the government providing assistance to Lehman and preventing them from having to declare bankruptcy?
Yes.
Okay. Can you at least start, describe those discussions for us, please, and then I'll follow up.
Okay, so I was present. Now let me just see how I frame this. So we were summoned to the Fed Saturday morning, I think it's September 13th.
Right.
We got there. We were asked to prepare a financial outlook for Lehman Brothers. And when I say me, it was myself and Bart McDade. We prepared some notes. We went and we met with at a round table in the first floor of the Fed. John Mack, John Fain, Vikram Pandit, and some of their senior people. And the topic of discussion was government, the Fed, had asked this group of banks to put together a plan on how to wind down Lehman Brothers over a long period of time, and what sort of funding would Lehman Brothers need, for what term, et cetera, how many people, the business plan effectively. We met and discussed that with that group Saturday morning for an hour and a half or so. We were then asked to return and work with our colleagues to put that together. When we were on our way from that meeting, we were stopped by Steve Shaffrin, I believe that's his name, mm-hmm. who was working for Henry Paulson at the time, and we were asked to focus all our efforts on trying to move forward with Barclays as a potential acquirer of the firm. And during those discussions, there was a lot of those discussions took place basically from midday Saturday through the middle of the morning on Sunday. Those discussions centered around, as you pointed out, three things. One, what was the form and the structure of the deal between Barclays and Lehman Brothers? What assets did Barclays want to exclude because they weren't, either they had a view or they weren't efficient from a bank capital standpoint? So they wanted to carve those assets out. That was approximately $50 billion in assets. We were then asked to also try to coordinate, as you said, have a group of Lehman Brothers executives try to get the rest of the street to do evaluation on those assets, with the thought being that that group would make a loan against those assets. We were asked to draft a term sheet for that loan and that financing, and then we would attempt to capitalize that with preferred stock and equity, and a loan from the rest of the street, and then Barclays would buy the rest of the operations. We spent that 24 hours working on that. Through the course of those discussions, it was made clear to us that the government, you know, had no interest and was not going to finance any of those assets. So that would be up to the consortium to finance those assets, and us to work through the appropriate structures, et cetera. Where we thought, obviously, that we were hopeful that that deal would be done Saturday, that didn't come to be the place. We then went back to Lehman, started to prepare for a variety of financial alternatives. We were summoned back down to the Fed, and I went back down to the Fed with Mr. McDade, Mr. Lowett, and Mr. Seary. And we were joined by our lawyers from Weil Gotshal, and then Tom Baxter from the Fed led a meeting which took place from 5 o'clock in the afternoon to 8 or 9 o'clock at night, which was broken up in the middle of that meeting for an hour and a half or so. All the participants on the other side left. During that meeting, we discussed a myriad of possibilities, or we attempted to discuss a myriad of possibilities and risks around those possibilities, and we were encouraged to file for bankruptcy during that meeting.
Okay, so let me back up. When you go to the Fed on Saturday the 13th and you're asked to prepare this financial outlook for Lehman Brothers, and you're working on that with Mr. McDade, and you also mentioned that the government asked for a plan on how to wind down Lehman Brothers over a long period of time. Can you provide some more color and specifics on exactly what you guys were doing in terms of that plan, you know, before Shaffrin says throw that away and focus on Barclays?
We spent some time agreeing on the framework, which was we were going to run it as primarily Vikram Pandit driving it, but Mac and Thane participating as well, and their senior folks, about trying to, you know, shrink the client base, run it like a asset manager, and over time try to return capital in an efficient, price efficient, get reasonable prices, and what financing structure would be appropriate, etc. We literally were given that homework assignment. We walked 75 feet and we were stopped by Steve Shaffrin, so we went on to our next assignment within minutes.
But when you were understanding that effort hardly got off the ground because you were stopped by Shaffrin almost immediately, what kind of, you know, you mentioned it was a wind down plan over a long period of time. What kind of time period were you guys looking at, and did this plan involve, you know, government assistance?
I guess what I'd say is my understanding specifically was it did not include government assistance, that it was going to be financed by the banks that were sitting around the table with us. We had, in addition, Lehman Brothers had over $100 billion of long-term debt which had an average life of, you know, 3 years or something of that nature. So you had, this was a plan that was at least contemplated. We hadn't done the work to see if it was realistic. Would take several years.
What was the thinking on, you know, was the belief at that time that, that Lehman would continue to be able to have its, you know, that the clearing banks would continue to clear trades, you know, going into the next week?
At the time, the belief was, I believe, I can't speak to those participants, but from my seat, it felt as if that they were trying to deal with this in a way that was somewhat similar to long-term capital management.
Okay, so are we, and just want to make sure we're talking apples and apples, because I think we might be talking past each other. Was this long-term wind-down simply a plan to dispose of assets that were, you know, that were either going to be earlier thrown into SpinCo or later, you know, that the private consortium was going to finance because Barclays didn't want to buy them? Or was it a more, you know, overall firm wind down, you know, of a $600 billion investment bank over several years?
It was the overall firm, as opposed to, at that time, that plan was going to be the overall firm, and it was not going to be the rump of assets that from a Barclays or B of A acquisition.
And that plan over several years was going to involve other Wall Street firms providing financing to the company, and if so, financing beyond just certain types of assets, or, you know, operating funding, you know, for running the day-to-day business.
They asked us to put together a plan that included operating expenses and costs specifically, so they could understand what they thought. Again, driven by Vikram Pandit, but certainly actively participated by Thane Mack and their senior people, so that they would fund not the what you would think of as the normal course operations of everything Lehman Brothers did, investment banking, equity. We would be out of the businesses of everything but winding down the asset base. That is correct. But they obviously needed to know if we were going to, during that period of time, you know, create a operating, you know, would we make net income or lose net income? That was a very complicated answer, or a very complicated equation. It was going to take, many days, and, you know, at least many hours of work, if not days.
Mm-hmm. And let me, you know,
it was speculative, obviously.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that we've heard from folks is that, you know, once the Barclays deal fell through, you know, the reason that the government folk, you know, said declare bankruptcy, and apparently the plan was, you know, put Lehman in bankruptcy, but keep the broker-dealer operating with access to the PDCF. But the reasoning we've heard about that decision as Plan B, since Plan A was the ring fence private consortium and the Barclays deal, was that, you know, the Fed couldn't or wouldn't. Provide financing for, you know, potentially $100-200 billion that would be necessary to finance trades if the clearing banks and others went away. But and that's why I'm asking you these questions, because it sounds like before Shaffrin comes and says focus on Barclays, that you guys were looking at you know, a long-term, more orderly wind-down of Lehman, and I'm just trying to understand sort of the financing aspect of that. I don't know if that helps you providing comment on that. Does it? I mean, can you help us understand that a little better?
Well, I guess I don't know how long anybody else at the, you know, the non-Lehman parties had been thinking about this, because this literally was giving us a homework assignment at the time. So when we arrived at the table at 8:30 in the morning, or whatever time it was sometime in the morning, mid-morning, and spent an hour and a half or 2 hours going through that, trying to them asking us a bunch of questions, us asking them a bunch of questions. It was anything from a, you know, it was long from a well-formed plan, for sure. The shortfall in financing vis-a-vis the settling of trades and clearing of trades was not discussed at that table, and was had not been thought of actively at that point in time, I don't believe.
Okay.
By them or by us.
Okay. So in this short amount of time on Saturday, anyway, that the plan, the homework assignment was work out a long-term wind-down solution, and this is obviously, or tell me if I'm right, means no acquisition and no government assistance, just private sector support to have a long-term orderly wind-down.
Yeah, and this was done at the same time as there were other tables dealing with other issues, like derivative counterparty issues was a whole other group of people that were at another table, and there was another table dealing with repo financing, et cetera. So, and there may have been others, but there were at least those three streams of work groups, including ours, going on at that time.
Okay. Is it accurate to say that those groups were also part of the long-term orderly wind-down homework assignment?
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you. I think, you know, each of these groups may, I'm sure, were trying to get as much information as they could about the internal workings of Lehman Brothers to basically assess the global counterparty risk of the firm, mm-hmm. and of their respective firms as well.
Right.
So that, I think, was, if not the primary, reason, certainly an important one.
Okay. So now take me to, you know, Shaffrin comes in and says, you know, switch gears, work to help the Barclays acquisition. Initially, please, generally describe your involvement in that.
So we were put in an area of the Federal Reserve, and we were in a conference room across the hallway from the Barclays team. So we were asked to, one, first understand and react to their acquisition proposal. So we, which broadly defined was they were going to assume all the debt and other obligations of Lehman. They were going to leave behind all the preferred stock of Lehman. Leave behind meaning in this, there would be a group of assets that they didn't want because they, according to their, what they told us was it didn't work in their bank capital framework, and those were primarily the real estate assets and the private equity assets. Those assets would be supported by the preferred stock, the capital that they would leave behind. They were going to pay a small amount of money for the common because you needed the common shareholders to vote for the deal, or the preferred shareholders did not have a vote. Mm-hmm. So the small amount, meaning a dollar a share or so, and then they were going to obviously take all the operations of the firm and all the assets except for the excluded ones, which was out of the $600 billion, you know, as I recall, $50 billion or so.
Right.
And then in addition, that caused the need to raise $35 billion or so of financing, to debt financing by the rest of the street, to support, along with the preferred stock, that the remaining co, so to speak, which would still be, which would be a separate corporate entity, and which led to us calling in and gathering up and starting the process, which ran itself, coordinated by other senior people at the firm, the valuation process of those specific assets. So the other firms could understand as to what the risk is they were being asked to finance, try to, one, opine on whether they would finance it, and two, at what price they would finance it, and under what terms.
Okay. So does that mean, if I did the math right, that the preferred equity was about $15 billion? It was being left behind?
Again, I apologize. I don't remember what the exact numbers were, but I think something like, you know, yeah, $20 billion of preferred, something like that.
Okay. So, and was it your understanding that the private consortium financing for the assets had been agreed to at some point?
I heard, although that it had been agreed to, that the street was going to do the financing. Although I never heard under what terms, and I did not hear that except through the grapevine, really. Mm-hmm. At late, 2 a.m. on Saturday, I heard that. But I did not receive a term sheet on that financing.
Okay. And when you say 2 a.m., do you really mean Sunday then?
Yeah, that's correct. Sunday morning.
Right. Okay. I know what I always think of that as Saturday night too. Okay. So, I mean, obviously we know the Barclays deal didn't happen. Tell us what you heard about why the Barclays deal didn't happen.
I'm sorry, repeat that again.
What's your understanding of why Barclays didn't go through with the deal?
I was told by Rajan Cohen that the FSA refused to provide a waiver of a shareholder vote which would allow Barclays to guarantee the trading and other interim obligations of Lehman Brothers prior to the close of the acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any discussion about whether or not, you know, Barclays knew that a shareholder vote was going to be required?
I don't recall a discussion about that. Certainly, well, I understood that normal corporate finance procedures in London would require a shareholder vote. The question of a necessary shareholder waiver to provide a guarantee prior to that was not something I was aware of or was discussed prior to learning that it was not waived.
Okay. Did you ever hear or participate in any discussions about when Barclays knew that part of the deal would be guaranteeing the obligations? Between the time the deal was announced and it closed?
I recall that we certainly let Barclays know at some point on Saturday, if not prior to that, that would be necessary, because it was our expectation that counterparties would not trade with Lehman Brothers if it was open yet subject to a merger with a shareholder vote, to continue operations.
And that
risk too high.
And you said that that Lehman told Barclays that on Saturday. Do you know who at Lehman told Barclays and who they told at Barclays about that requirement?
Well, we may have highlighted it Friday when we started the discussions with Barclays, so I can't tell you that. It would have been, I don't know specifically, but besides myself, Bart McDay was there, and Mark Schaefer was there down at the Fed. Representing Barclays was Bob Diamond, Rich Ritchie, Jerry Del Messier, and Michael Klein, and Archibald Cox. So it would have been one or more of those individuals.
One of the things we've heard in some of the interviews we've done was surprise, and that might be using a kind term, reaction by the government and by folks at Lehman at the at either the fact that Barclays couldn't guarantee the obligations without a shareholder vote or couldn't get it waived, because everybody knew all along that those kind of guarantees were required. And indeed, J.P. Morgan had to guarantee Bear's obligations between the time it did the government-assisted deal, the time it announced the government-assisted deal back in March of 08 and closing. And again, surprise might be kind. Some folks have said, they were somewhat taken aback by this becoming an issue, since it was a well-known requirement of any kind of deal. Do you recall any discussions along those lines when you're there at the Fed during the weekend?
I can't speak for others, but I can say I was extremely disappointed in that message, for sure.
And understanding you were extremely disappointed, I mean, can you comment at all on some of the things we've been hearing that, essentially, what are you talking about? Everybody knew that the requirement to guarantee the obligations would be part of the deal, and for this to come up, on the weekend is less than ideal.
Well, the message was delivered to Mr. McDay by, he was called out of the room up to meet with, I don't know who specifically, number one. So he got the message, and then he told me, this is Sunday morning. I don't believe the Barclays people did not deliver us that message, and they were not in the room. So, I was reacting to Bart and discussing it with Rajan Cohen, and it was certainly shock, surprise, and disappointment, but there was no forum to sort of call anybody out on it.
Well, and understanding that, though, when you're talking to Mr. McDade and Mr. Cohen or anyone else, I mean, are there discussions of this is nuts? I mean, like I said, everybody knew that guaranteeing the obligations would be part of the deal, and for us to hear about, one, a shareholder requirement, and two, the FSA failing to waive that shareholder requirement, this should have been dealt with a lot earlier.
I can certainly say that was my reaction, for sure. But recall that we actually didn't even start to deal with Barclays until, Friday afternoon. So this is a very compressed time frame. There were parallel processing many, many different things with Barclays, with B of A, with the rest of the group down at the Fed, so that it was a they our flagging of that issue was no earlier than 48 hours, but no later than 24 hours. So it was, you know, it was a that was a pretty short time frame.
Right, and no, I mean, understanding that Barclays wasn't at the table till Friday, so no time before that, when you came back in July of 08, Barclays wasn't kicking the tires, so to speak, or looking at Lehman before Friday the 12th?
You know, I think that our financial institutions, bankers, and the lawyers working on our behalf, and Lazard called every financial institution they could think of. I'm sure they called Barclays in that round of, I was not involved directly in those discussions, but, you know, there was a very broad net cast. I'm sure Barclays was in that net at some point, but no serious discussions that I'm aware of prior to Friday the 12th.
Okay. So let's now move to, you know, discussions with the government once you're informed that the Barclays deal is not going to happen because the FSA won't waive the shareholder requirement. So can you explain to us, you know, what discussions there were with the government at this point about, you know, government assistance or alternatives to filing bankruptcy?
We returned to Lehman Brothers in the middle of, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, noon, something like that. We were there discussing internally the various, what should we do. There was a conference call arranged by Tom Russo with the Fed and which I participated in. There was a large group of people in the room listening to this call. I want to say 15 or 20 people. There were a lot of people on the other end of the phone. During that conference call, the Fed was asking us, well, what are your plans? What are you specifically going to do, et cetera? We said we haven't actually figured it out yet. It became clear that format, there were lots of people talking over lots of people, was not useful. We volunteered to come back down to the Fed, which they said they would like us to do. So four of us dispatched back downtown, Bart McDade, Ian Lowett, Jim Seary, and myself. And we met with a group of Fed and SEC officials, the ones that about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the ones that I recognized and remembered. Tom Baxter, the general counsel, led the meeting. Bill Dudley was in the room. A woman whose name I don't recall, but the chief bank examiner for the New York Fed was in the room. Eric Seary from the SEC was in the room. And then there were about, I want to say, there were some other officials whose names I don't know. And I would say about a dozen lawyers. So there were about 25 people on that side of the table. And then on our side of the table, there were the four individuals I mentioned. Harvey Miller from Weil Gotshal, Tom Roberts from Weil Gotshal, Lori Fife from Weil Gotshal.
So Mr. Cohen's not there?
No, Rajan Cohen was not there.
Okay, so describe the meeting for me, please.
So, the beginning of the meeting, they were asking us to go through in detail what our financing plan was for the next 24 hours. Number one. So we, Ian Lowett spent time trying to describe what the variables were that would affect that, particularly the uncertainty as to what would happen with all the trades that were going to settle on Monday, i.e., would anybody deliver us cash against the trading position for settlement that day, given the risk involved. And those numbers were, you know, tens of billions of dollars, so the swing in liquidity was potentially very large. So we spent a lot of time discussing that. We then were told that the Fed would provide us financing against then eligible assets to be financed by the Fed, and they were going to provide that financing with for this the strict purpose of paying back the financing counterparties, i.e. anybody who had a repo line outstanding with Lehman Brothers, the broker dealer. In the U.S. We had then had a long series of discussions about the necessity from our point of view of being able to move money sort of through the system as we normally had between the various entities, but it was explained to us that each legal entity would now be a box in and of to itself, and we were prohibited from moving any money in or out of the broker-dealer or in and out of any of the other regulated subsidiaries as far as the Fed understood around the rest of the globe who they had been working closely with, Bank of Japan, the FSA, et cetera, Bank of England. So there was a series of discussions that took place around that. And then there was a series of discussions. Then the Fed broke, and all the officials on the other side of the table went to another meeting. They were gone for over an hour, and they came back. And as they sat with us during that, they said to us specifically, you know, first of all, you know, are you planning on filing bankruptcy tonight? And Harvey said that we had not made a definitive decision about that. They said, well, they were aware that there was some potential personal liability for our directors in London if they did not file LBIE that night, because as a director you have personal liability if you don't file an insolvent company in the UK. We told them that whatever the LBIE did, that didn't necessarily mean we would file that night. We may take a day or so to make sure that we got all our ducks in a row to protect ourselves, and Harvey explained them, et cetera. We also explained to them that they asked, well, how long would it take you to file? Harvey pointed out that no one in the room with them was authorized to file the company. Only the board of directors could make that decision. And the board had to be called to a meeting and have a vote before we could do it, and then there would be some lag in terms of having to put all the papers together to actually file it, you know. So there was a practical issue that you couldn't push a button and get it done quickly. They then told us that, well, we would like you to file tonight. We think it's the right thing to do because there's something else which we can't tell you, which is going to happen this evening, and we would like this action and that action to happen both tonight before the opening of trading Monday morning.
And
we told them, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, finish, please.
We said, we understand, we hear you. We will recommend that the board do that if that's the right thing for the country. We left the Fed early that evening and went back to Lehman.
Okay. Let me back up, and then we'll finish the story. The thing that they couldn't tell you what was happening was that B of A's acquisition of Merrill, do you think?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know that that's what it was?
That's what it turned out to be.
Right, okay. When the Barclays deal fell through and Mr. Lowett was taking them through the variables, and they said, one, you know, the Fed will provide PDCF financing to the broker-dealer for its U.S. repo counterparties, and two, that Lehman could not move money, you know, out of the broker-dealer or its regulated subsidiaries. What did that mean in terms of, you know, Lehman continuing on a standalone basis?
Well, it was specifically stated that the money the Fed would lend us would go through Lehman directly to those repo counterparties, so it wouldn't provide any liquidity for Lehman. So that was gone. And two, like any financial institution, the inability to move money between your various subsidiaries will shut you down very quickly. So it was, and the filing of bankruptcy will shut you down. So either the bankruptcy filing or those other actions, you know, each would have caused the Lehman Brothers to cease to operate.
So were there when those two points were made by the government in terms of the PDCF and not being able to move money around, I mean, was there discussion of, guys, that's no different than telling us to file bankruptcy?
Well, I'll be specific. The PDCF, not really, because just to be clear, right, that would have shrunk our financing obligations of the guys. So that in and of itself was not as problematic as either this inability to move money between legal entities or filing. So the inability to move money between legal entities in and of itself would have caused us to file within, you know, certainly within days.
Okay. So understanding that that's what you guys understood, and that the Fed or the government, since we're talking more than the Fed here, had told you folks that they thought the right thing to do, or however you said it, or they would like you to file, and that it was the best thing to do. Were there discussions about, you know, an alternative to a bankruptcy filing or a bankruptcy filing a few days down the road? And specifically, was there any talk about providing government assistance and the potential systemic implications of Lehman filing bankruptcy?
There were some discussions about the systemic implications of Lehman filing, specifically around the failure of the collapse of all of the derivative contracts that Lehman was counterparty to that would have been triggered under a bankruptcy. The Fed and our concern about that. The Fed said they had examined that and they were willing to take that risk. The other side of the table. There was a discussion of all of the unfunded revolvers that Lehman Brothers was a party to corporate America and the rest of the globe, and potentially would this cause a panic among corporate borrowers, you know, and get them to draw down all these revolvers because they were worried about their banks being able to fund going forward. So there was a discussion that that is a risk. They were willing to accept that risk. There was a discussion of the prime brokerage accounts and the financing securities that Lehman had at LBIE. There was a discussion of they were willing to accept that risk. So the message was from the government this time: we've looked at all these risks. We're willing to accept them in this case.
Okay.
Excuse me, was I in Steve Kelly? I had scheduled this. I thought you folks needed an hour. I got a conflict at 5:30. How much more time do you think you'll need?
I'll try to hustle and get done in 14 minutes. Let me. And if we don't, we can. I don't have a lot more time, so if we don't finish, I'm happy to stop and pick up, you know, for 15, 30 minutes some other time. But as you can tell, I'm mainly interested in these too big to fail systemic risk type discussions. And since we're there, let me try to hustle and finish up in the next 14 minutes so you can make your appointment. Sound good?
Yep.
Okay. So. And so let me follow up on that. One of the things we've seen is that apparently on Sunday from 2 to 6, there was a meeting of various derivatives counterparties, and they did a big netting exercise. Were you aware of that or involved in any of that?
From my understanding is that I was aware that had taken place because several of the clients of the firm had called Lehman and told them. Lehman was not involved directly in that. All that netting took place away from Lehman Brothers.
Okay. Do you have any idea of how much of the derivatives book that resolved? I mean, we've seen reference to that there were, you know, prior to the bankruptcy, 930,000 derivative contracts.
That number actually sounds low to me. I thought the number was in the millions, but I don't know how much of it got resolved. I've never heard any sort of numbers associated with that.
Okay. To the extent you, well, let me ask you, when the government says we've looked at all the risks and we're willing to accept these, is there further discussion? I mean, one of the things we've heard is, you know, that apparently Mr. Miller or others, you know, told the government it's going to be friggin' Armageddon if this company declares bankruptcy, and that things got somewhat heated. Can you provide any color on that?
I would say there was some passionate discussion from our side as to our concern, but at that point in time, it was clear to us that the government's view was the right thing to do was to file that night for reasons that we were beyond our understanding and information, and that they knew better.
Mm-hmm. So, if you can comment, you know, obviously Lehman did file for bankruptcy, and one of the things we're looking at is trying to get an understanding of what the actual fallout was of the bankruptcy. Can you comment on that, and in particular on the three areas that you mentioned?
When you say the three areas, what do you mean specifically?
Can you comment post-bankruptcy on, you know, the collapse of derivative contracts, whether or not revolver borrowers, you know, panicked and started drawing down lines from other lenders, or, you know, what was happening with prime brokerage accounts at other banks?
You know, I know nothing beyond, specifically beyond what I've read in the papers and books and things, which certainly seems like there was a full-on panic around all of those issues. I don't have any specific evidence of that.
Any discussions
and,
that you've
had other firms?
Sure. Any discussions that you've had with anyone within in the government and particularly the folks that were part of this meeting on Sunday the 14th after the fact about whether, you know, they said, boy, maybe we should have gone a different route?
I've never talked to anybody who was in that meeting since then.
What about, you know, just generally, or let me...
Never anybody from the government.
Understanding that, any discussions with any other folks about, you know, gee, maybe they should have gone another route, or discussions they may have had with the government, any secondhand information?
Beyond, you know, just, well, it was me, cocktail party talk, you know, and the state of the financial markets for the next 6 months, no, nothing that was substantive.
Right. Nobody ever told you, for example, that, yeah, you know, Baxter told me or Dudley told me or whoever, you know, said, I wish we would have done things differently given what happened with the fallout from the bankruptcy.
No, I never got any back channel feedback, except obviously the press, the, you know, and you know, all the things that have been written.
Right. Okay. Mr. Kirk, I think that's all I've got for you. So I'll tell you what I tell everybody. You know, we'll look at our notes, and if we figure out there's something we forgot to ask you, we'll call your lawyer and see if we can do a quick few-minute conference call. And, of course, now that I'm telling you I have nothing else, one of my colleagues has one follow-up question, so hold on one sec.
It's just point of curiosity more than anything else. Saturday night, did you go home or did you spend the evening between the Fed and Lehman?
That's a personal question. I went home. I got about, I think I got 2.5 hours of sleep.
Thank you.
Okay, again, Mr. Kirk, and counsel, thank you very much for your time, and we'll be in touch if we want to do a short follow-up phone call.
Okay.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.